New research published at the end of last month presents evidence that a new variant of COVID has been identified in a white-tailed deer herd in Canada. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn and for Kate Archer Kent, and those researchers have now also identified a person who lives nearby the herd who had contact with a deer and has also been infected with that same new variant. Most likely, and disconcerting hypothesis being that the white-tailed deer are spreading COVID and could be infecting people. We're taking this hour to try to wrap our heads around what we can expect next with this virus and how we can stay safe. So what is it you want to know about COVID and its spread? What are you doing, if anything, anymore to stay safe? 1-800-642-1234 to join us. Email ideas at WPR.org. Suresh Kuchipudi is a professor and chair of emerging infectious diseases at Pennsylvania State University. Suresh, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. Tell us a little bit about what you're working on right now and what you're finding when it comes to COVID.
So we've been working on multiple aspects of SARS coronavirus 2, the cause of COVID-19. In particular, the focus was to see its spillover into animal species, because a zoonotic virus that emerged from animals is likely to also spill back into animals. And as we have seen over the past 2 years, the virus did indeed infect multiple animal species, including a lot of natural infections of white-tailed deer across the country, and now reports from Canada. So we're currently investigating whether the virus is continued to circulate among white-tailed deer, and if so, is the virus changing, and what are the potential implications to animal health and also public health?
Yeah, so Suresh, you find a new a variant of COVID, and then you find that same variant from a white-tailed deer in a human?
So just to clarify, this study was not done by our group. The particular study you mentioned about Canada, it's a study by another scientist in Canada. So what they have found is a significantly mutated version of SARS coronavirus 2 in deer, and they called it as the white-tailed deer clade, and just wanted to confirm that this has not been given a status of a variant yet. So we would not call it as a variant.
Okay.
It has lots of changes genetically. And as you have mentioned, there was one individual identified with infection with this particular white-tailed deer clade.
So it's not a variant, but there are genetic differences to the COVID that we've become familiar with.
Exactly. And particularly those changes that were found in this version of SARS coronavirus 2 in white-tailed deer have not been found in humans. And that actually helped the scientists to conclude that the individual found infected with this version has indeed got the infection from deer.
So does this research support or at least seem to be in line with the research that you're doing at Penn State, Suresh?
So certainly the fact that white-tailed deer are naturally infected with SARS coronavirus 2 is now fairly well established by multiple groups. So the research we have done in collaboration with our partners across the country and independently, a group from Ohio State University and also the University of Pennsylvania, there were multiple reports now. And now this is certainly in line with what we have done here and what the reports coming from Canada. And also, just to further add to that, a recent publication from the University of Pennsylvania, they also have found two alpha lineage SARS coronavirus 2 isolates in deer in Pennsylvania that are highly diverged from their original human version. So what it means is that the virus at some point spilled into deer and it continued to spread. And in the process, the virus accumulated more mutations. So the genetic version of the virus is further drifting apart from its parent virus from humans.
And why, and what does that mean for us and public health? Is there concern that the mutations in white-tailed deer, if they were to jump back to humans, could be more dangerous?
So in the short term, I think it is important to recognize that the significant risk of SARS coronavirus to infection to people are the other human beings who are infected. And certainly the role of animals at this point in passing on the virus to people is significantly low or almost non-existent. However, the key concern is that as we all are working towards bringing this pandemic to an end and come back to a certain level of normality, and whenever the virus finds another host as a safe haven to continue to circulate, in this case, it could be white-tailed deer or maybe other animals, then the virus is likely to continue to stay around and change and mutate. And at some point, the virus may significantly change and it gives rise possibilities for novel variants to emerge. And they may have different properties. They could undermine the protection of current vaccines, or they could be more pathogenic, but simply we cannot predict. But the concern is that we cannot let this virus continue to circulate unmonitored in animals, because that could potentially complicate the efforts to mitigate this pandemic. But more importantly, it will have consequences to both animal health and also human health down the road. Mm.
Suresh Kuchipudi is our guest. He's a professor and chair of emerging infectious diseases at Pennsylvania State University. And if you've got a question, 1-800-642-1234. I'd be interested in knowing what you'd like to know about possible COVID transmission through animals. And Suresh, why are you studying deer? What is it about these white-tailed deer that that are interesting?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we did not start with white-tailed deer. As I mentioned earlier, we are interested in studying the spillover of viruses between animals and humans. We call them as zoonotic viruses. And since the emergence of SARS coronavirus 2, we have been studying a number of aspects of this virus, including its ability to infect different animal species. So we started off with our focus on livestock species, cattle, pigs, and poultry. And in the process, there were lots of other studies that were published and which gave an opportunity to look at all possible animal species. And based on the sequence of their ACE2 receptor, they have been classified as potentially susceptible or highly susceptible into different groups. And white-tailed deer, because of the ACE2 receptor being very similar to humans, they are classified as highly susceptible. And subsequently, experimental studies were done to confirm that they are indeed susceptible. And USDA has done a field-level survey, which also confirmed antibody evidence of white-tailed deer in four different states. Nearly 40% of animals showed antibody evidence of SARS-CoV-2 exposure. So that prompted us to shift our focus and start looking at white-tailed deer, because there was evidence, but we needed to get the concrete evidence of the viral nucleic acid in the deer. And therefore, we partnered with the Department of Natural Resources in Iowa, who have been conducting surveillance for chronic wasting disease in deer. And the type of tissue they collect for the chronic wasting disease surveillance, the retropharyngeal lymph node, is also can be used to detect for COVID. So that allowed us to go back in time and use those previously collected samples to demonstrate that there was a widespread natural infection of white-tailed deer in Iowa.
How common is it for the viruses to hop between humans and other animals, Suresh?
It is not uncommon. We know that many viruses did this and continue to do so. And one classic example I can give is the flu viruses, influenza viruses. And influenza viruses have multiple hosts that they can infect, and they continue to expand their host range. And these viruses also transmit between different hosts, birds to terrestrial birds, to aquatic birds, and back and forth. And in the process, they evolve. And as we can look back, several of the past influenza pandemics were now believed to be caused by viruses that came out of animals, particularly birds. So this is not very uncommon. And even if we think about other potentially deadly viruses like Ebola or Hendra, Nipah, all of them have animal origins. So the zoonotic viruses spillover and spillback is not a new thing.
Suresh Kuchipudi is a professor and chair of emerging infectious diseases at Penn State. Take your questions about where this zoonotic back and forth could go next. 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. So white-tailed deer can catch COVID, and some new evidence shows how those deer may be passing the virus or could possibly pass the virus back to people. We've got some similarities in our receptors that makes it a possibility, and evidence suggests it may have happened already in Canada. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn. And if that's the deer, what about our cats and dogs? What about farm animals? And what can we expect next if COVID-19 is getting a foothold in our wildlife population? Care to speculate or ask the expert? 1-800-642-1234 to join us, or email ideas at WPR.org. Suresh Kuchipudi is a professor and chair of emerging infectious diseases at Penn State University. So, and you mentioned the 40% number, the white-tailed deer showing antibodies that would suggest that the COVID would be rather rampant in some of these herds, Suresh. But, and again, I go back to what this means for public health. If this is going back and forth in wildlife populations, would we ever be able to contain it in a human population?
Yeah, that's a very important question. So just to also put things into perspective, the 40% or over 40% antibody evidence of SARS-CoV-2 in multiple states was an earlier study from USDA in 2021, early 2021. And subsequently, the study we conducted in collaboration with our partners, the samples came from April of 2020 to January 2021. And the more recent studies, we have also just recently released a preprint study that found the spillover of Omicron and Delta in white-tailed deer in New York City. And this study is also available now on preprint server. And the other studies are also late 2021 and recently. So what it tells us is that right from the start of the pandemic, early perhaps September 2020 and all along, the spillover of SARS coronavirus 2 into white-tailed deer has continued to happen. And we only know a snapshot of what was happening because there were only a handful of studies that were done. So now the much bigger questions of this one is, although there were ongoing surveillance programs and mechanisms for us to collect samples from white-tailed deer and to test them, we came to know that white-tailed deer in natural settings have been infected. But there are lots of unknowns in this situation. So, for example, there are other peri-domestic animals like deer, mice, or skunks, raccoons that also live in the same ecological spaces and share or live closely with the deer. And the question is whether these animals also have been infected, and we haven't really gotten evidence of that. And you can imagine simply that if this virus has infected multiple species, the transmission networks and the complexity of virus ecology is perhaps much more complex than currently we understand. And that can be a significant problem if we do not address soon enough that will allow the virus to continue to maintain, and the virus will have opportunities to evolve and emerge, and novel variants could always threaten public health.
Yeah, so how concerned should I be that if the COVID is running rampant in wild animal populations, that those wild animal populations would return some modified version of COVID back to the human population? Is this something we expect? Is this how likely is it, Suresh?
Yeah, so there are different levels of aspects that we need to consider. So as I mentioned earlier, in the short term, for most general public, the risk of getting infection from a wild animal is much more less likely than getting infected from a human being. So in general, one aspect is that if most people or everybody who have not considered or who have not vaccinated, if we all vaccinate, then that can significantly cut down the source of the virus in the first place, that is spilling into animals. But from a more of a research and a policy standpoint, this is certainly concerning medium to long term, because this is a problem that could grow and become a context where we might be caught blindsided or completely taken by surprise if a novel variant emerges out of these animal populations. Just also for context, we know that the Omicron variant is the by far the significantly mutated version of SARS coronavirus 2. It is still not clear how exactly Omicron has emerged. And one of the leading hypotheses is that perhaps the virus has also mutated in an unmonitored population of animals, and that led to the emergence of Omicron. Although this is not confirmed, but one of the leading hypotheses. So that kind of situations can happen in the future if we do not address this much more comprehensively.
Suresh Kuchipudi is a professor and chair of emerging infectious diseases at Penn State. And if you have a question, 1-800-642-1234 or email quickideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Gary in Boscobel. Gary, you're on with Suresh Kuchipudi.
Thank you. My question is whether these viruses could wipe out local populations of native birds. Here in western Wisconsin, we've lost a whole list of native birds. Some people believe it's to habitat loss. Some people believe it may be to insect populations plummeting, which provide food for young birds. Right now we're in the midst of wild turkey populations plummeting like crazy. I've been doing surveys all winter and seeing a huge reduction in turkey populations. So I'm wondering whether a silent killer to these bird populations could be viruses of some kind that don't show up in human populations but can wipe out vast numbers of native bird populations.
Gary, thank you. And Suresh, you were just talking about unmonitored wildlife populations and where the Omicron variant may have come from. So what do we know about birds? And do we have any information about our wild turkey population?
Yeah, so Gary, that's a great question. So with regards to SARS coronavirus 2, based on all the scientific information we have today, it appears that birds are not susceptible to SARS coronavirus 2. So the chances of wild birds or other bird species getting infected with SARS coronavirus 2 is probably extremely less likely. But to your point, there are many, many aspects that may have contributed to the reduction of wild bird population, including some of them could be viral infections. So, for example, the highly pathogenic avian influenza, the bird flu virus, is now widely found across the U.S. And there were several places where we have now found domestic poultry being infected. So other viral pathogens that particularly affect birds could be a contributing factor. But as you mentioned, there are other aspects, including habitat loss and many other factors contribute to the reduction of wild birds.
Gary, thank you for the call. Let's go to Peter in Sturtevant. Peter, you are on the air with Suresh Kuchipudi. Peter? Sorry, we missed you there, Peter. Suresh, I do want to know before we're done, from your perspective as a chair of emerging infectious diseases at Pennsylvania State University, what more needs to be done right now to look at the effects of COVID-19 on animals?
Yeah, that's a very, very important question. So I think what we need to do is have a much more comprehensive surveillance of animals so we better understand the current nature of the problem. And let me explain what I mean by that. So we know that white-tailed deer in multiple locations have been infected. But as I mentioned earlier, we do not know what other animal species may have been infected. And the key question is, who is giving virus to who? And that is very, very critical, because that will help us to determine the routes of transmission. So again, another question is, we also do not fully know how white-tailed deer are getting infected in the first place. What is the source? Is it directly from people, or are they indirect transmission routes through other animal species or through wastewater or environmental contamination? So a much more comprehensive surveillance is needed, so we better define the problem. And that would allow us to find solutions and efforts to mitigate this problem so we can address the ongoing potential threats to human health, but also maybe threats to animal species.
Hey, Suresh, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much for having me.
Suresh Kuttapudi is a professor and chair of emerging infectious diseases at Penn State. News is next. Then we hear from a UW-Milwaukee School of Freshwater Science professor about the latest on testing for COVID-19. Where will we find it next? We're looking. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and for Kate Archer-Kent, and we're taking this hour to ask the experts what we can expect next from this pandemic. Fatality rates have fallen off since the latest surge, while warnings of another new variant are once again growing in volume. Have we fallen behind in keeping each other safe? Does it feel like we've spent the last 2 years chasing this disease instead of figuring out how to get ahead of it? Hospitalizations, hospital beds, they may show us where COVID has been, but how can we best anticipate where it will be next? After all, isn't that what we all want to know? Take your questions this morning at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Sandra McClellan is a professor in the School of Freshwater Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. Sandra, good morning.
Good morning.
One of the ways we've been tracking COVID-19 is through our wastewater. And tell us what's the latest results from our wastewater testing?
Well, they're actually looking pretty good. We were pleased to see a drop over the last couple of weeks, and they've been staying down. And that's really good news because, you know, testing has kind of been dropping off, and also people are testing at home. So the testing statistics that we see all the time on the news sometimes might not be the best kind of alert that something's going on. But the fact that we see it low in wastewater, I think, is really good news.
And how effective has our wastewater testing been in identifying where COVID has been, where, and its rate of increase or decrease?
You know, we have been testing wastewater for, you know, all the way back to summer of 2020. And that has allowed us to track what we see in wastewater side by side with times where we've had really intense clinical testing, where we, you know, are pretty sure we know what's going on. And what that's done over the last 18 months has kind of built confidence that we can really trust the numbers we see, and we're starting to understand what they mean. You know, when they get above a certain level, yes, you know, we have more concern, and when we see them drop, we can be confident. So seeing, you know, kind of seeing what's happening now has been really useful to confirm that it really is dropping in the community.
And where are we testing our wastewater? Are there just certain regions? Are we trying to test it just anywhere we can?
You know, it is actually statewide in Wisconsin, and there's a couple of states in the United States that have really you know, built robust kind of wastewater surveillance programs. And I'm really proud to say Wisconsin has been one of them to be in the forefront. So there's actually maybe 40 or 50 different wastewater treatment plants that are tested twice a week statewide. And if you go on the Department of Health Services website under Wisconsin Coronavirus Wastewater Monitoring, and I always get there by just Googling, okay, Wisconsin wastewater and COVID, that will get me there every time to their page. You can see a map of all the different cities that have been monitored, and this is updated twice a week. So 40 or 50 across the state really gives us an idea of what's going on statewide, not just in Milwaukee where I test, or up in Green Bay, but we partner with the Wisconsin State Lab of Hygiene, and they really do the heavy lifting on monitoring the other wastewater treatment plants around the state.
Why is Wisconsin so comprehensive in its wastewater testing, Sandra?
You know, I think we just got lucky and the right people kind of partnered at the right time. So this is something I've actually worked on for a long time, not on COVID-19, but we have looked at wastewater to look for different infectious disease agents. And we've also looked for like antibiotic resistance. So when the pandemic started, myself and some of the other colleagues that do this type of work around the country started talking and building our methods. But I have also worked with the Department of Health Services here in Wisconsin before and also our state lab of hygiene. So we were already kind of, knew each other and could jump on this right away. So we got our program up and running, like I said, in August of 2020. And I feel like that really put us ahead of the curve. So there's still some states that really haven't even started testing, or maybe they don't have the right expertise in the state. But I think we were lucky to have the right people in Wisconsin to do this right away.
Sandra McClellan joining us, professor in the School of Freshwater Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. And what would you like to know about COVID monitoring through our sewage systems? 1-800-642-1234. How we use these indicators to try to figure out where this virus is going next. Email ideas at WPR.org. And Sandra, I'll ask you, I mean, as working in the School of Freshwater Sciences, having tested wastewater before COVID, and how do you use this data to keep you and yours safe?
You know, I actually look at the dashboard pretty often, and I refer a lot of my friends to it. I think that, our kind of particular area and our state in general has done a really good job with kind of the public health, priorities of wear a mask and especially when we had the lockdown, I think that was really critical so that our health system could kind of catch up and be ready for these waves that have come. So I rely on the data, in my own life when I think, should I travel? Should I go to Florida? Should I, is it safe to go out to restaurants? So I've used it both ways, confidence to have more activity, and also as, kind of a warning sign that things are on the rise right now. Maybe I shouldn't host that Packer party. Maybe I should just keep it to my family this Sunday.
Packer party in the parking lot. That's always an option too, depending on the weather. So do you see the wastewater testing as a leading indicator for where this virus is going?
I think it definitely will be, as like I said earlier, when we have less clinical testing. We have been on this heightened awareness for so long, and people have been getting tested. But now that we're kind of moving into this endemic phase, meaning it's at low levels and kind of everywhere, I've heard anecdotally people are a little less, likely to get tested. They think, well, I'll just stay home. And also, we have the ability to test at home. So if you do come up positive, you might tell your family and friends and, I'm going to isolate, but you're not necessarily going to report it. So the public health departments might not have an idea how many people are ill out there. And that is really where wastewater is going to come in handy, as an early warning that, something is going on in the community. And then the other thing we're always worried about is these variants that are coming up. And we can test for those, too, in wastewater. We saw the Omicron variant show up really the last week in November. And we went back and could look at that after it was identified. So now we know wastewater can be used for that. Whenever a variant is reported, we start testing for it in Wisconsin right away.
Would you be able to identify a new variant if it had not been identified yet in our wastewater?
A lot of people are working on that. Because there is so much sequencing of clinical samples, so the public health labs will get the full genome sequences, and that's how they're really identifying these variants. Because that's such a robust system right now, that has been kind of our first indication. Like when the Omicron came out of South Africa, that was reported right away, and the CDC does a great job of kind of informing all the scientists around the country of what they're seeing in the sequencing data. That said, we're also trying to sequence in wastewater, and it's more challenging. So it's hard to know. It's really hard to interpret that data, but we're making great progress. So I think in a year or two, yes, we will be able to use wastewater to see maybe something new But for the meantime, I think our clinician work is kind of covering that base.
Sandra, where's this money coming from for our sewage testing? And is there any concern with folks wanting this to be over that there may be, that we may lose our opportunity to continue to monitor this main indicator?
You know, I think there's been a national commitment for this. So the money that comes to the states through our Department of Health Services comes from the CDC. And the CDC has been funded and has really good funding for a national wastewater surveillance program. And they also call that NEWS. And so they've really committed to the long term on this because they see that it's not just useful for COVID. So when this does die down, we can use it for other things like antibiotic resistance or, you know, other kind of pathogens or disease agents that we might worry about, like norovirus is one that goes through our communities in winter. It's the 24-hour flu, so to speak. And that's one that we can test for in wastewater. So I think testing wastewater is going to be useful long-term to look at population health, and the CDC really recognizes that.
And Sandra, if you had an unlimited budget and you were in charge of things well beyond, you know, just the School of Freshwater Sciences at UW-Milwaukee, what more would you have us be doing?
You know, in terms of testing wastewater and the science?
Or just testing or trying to figure out where this virus is going next.
Right. I think the surveillance is really important. And one thing we don't really understand, the big missing link between the wastewater numbers that we see and, you know, how much it's in the community, is we can see the trends, but we don't know, is it 10% of the population? Is it 20% of the population? So there are some good epidemiology studies that are going on where they test people randomly to see how much COVID is in the community, and then they look at the wastewater. And these have been small studies in a couple of specific locations, and I think we really need more of those because, like I said, we can look at these numbers and say it's going up or down, and we can compare it to what did we see last winter? What happened, you know, when we had that big surge in 2020? How does it compare to that? But we have not nailed down how many, you know, actual people might be sick, the density of people. So I think that would be a really valuable piece of information. And I hope those studies will get funded in the future.
Sandra McClellan is our guest. She is a professor in the School of Freshwater Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. And we're taking your questions about the leading indicators for this virus, where it's going next. And right now, it seems to be in a lull, at least in the sewage water across the state. What do you want to know before we're done? 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation. You can always email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. You know, I still catch myself saying, when this is all over, although I know the evidence suggests that this COVID may very well be with us forever. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn. And I guess it's just a coping mechanism, a way to pray for a better day, I suppose. Meanwhile, places like Thailand, Indonesia, and the Philippines are beginning to transition from treating this virus as a pandemic to an endemic that is here to stay, albeit without the spikes and surges. So how are you preparing, if at all, for what COVID may do next? And what exactly should we be doing to make certain that there is a better day? Time for you to tell us at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. You can also ask questions of our guest, Sandra McClellan, who is a professor in the School of Freshwater Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. And Sandra, here's an interesting one. I don't believe this. Can someone contract COVID-19 from wastewater?
Oh, that's a really good question. And oddly, I've been getting that question a lot the last couple of days. So I wonder if there's maybe some misinformation or misstatements out there because we're very certain that the COVID that we detect in sewage is not viable. So we're just detecting the genetic material as a marker. So think about a respiratory virus. It's pretty wimpy. When it gets into the environment, it really needs to get into another person or it dies pretty quickly. think about flushing that virus down the toilet, you know, in dirty water and through a sewer system for 12 to 24 hours. It dies fairly quickly. So when it is in sewage, we're sure it's not viable. And it's also at really low levels. When somebody sneezes, it's millions of copies that are, you know, of the virus that are going into the air. Whereas in sewage, we probably have about a million copies in a whole liter of sewage. So you would essentially have to be exposed to a whole liter of untreated concentrated sewage to equate to one sneeze. So overall, all of the experts agree it's really a very, very low risk, if a risk at all.
And it makes sense as you explain it that way. But let's go a step further before we flush and give us some idea of how COVID-19 moves through our body before it gets into the sewage water. And how does that happen?
You know, it's a little interesting for this virus that it is shed through the feces through our body. Because usually respiratory viruses, you think about the reservoir in our upper respiratory tract and not in other parts of our body. But for some people, not everybody, but maybe about half the population, it also gets into our intestines and seems to be able to multiply there and kind of take up residence. Now, even when it's shed, it's not as viable as it would be in the respiratory tract, but it is shed. But again, it's much more concentrated and much more viable in the respiratory tract. So that's your bigger risk. Even if somebody's sick, it's so much easier to get it through the air rather than kind of hand contact or poor sanitation.
And you'd mentioned before that this is not the only thing that you test for in our wastewater. What are some of the other diseases you're looking at, Sandra?
You know, one of our high priorities is looking at antibiotic resistance, because we know that people over time have been taking more and more antibiotics. And as you take antibiotics, the bacteria in us get smart and they know how to overcome them and be resistant to them. So within the community, it's hard to know how many people carry antibiotic resistant bacteria that if it gets into the wrong place, like a urinary tract infection or pneumonia, it can't be treated. But we also carry those kind of bacteria just normally in our body. So think about if they're in our intestinal tract, we can look in sewage to see how much of the community is carrying some of these bad bugs, and especially the ones that are resistant to some of the antibiotics we really need to overcome these diseases. One of the common terms is CRE, carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae. And I know that's a mouthful, but it's a whole class of organisms that we're really worried about, because carbapenem is one of those last-line antibiotics. So that's a high priority for us to look at how much of that is floating around our community, and importantly, you know, does it go up over time? Do we see over years that it's more of a concern?
Yeah. Sandra, what concerns you? I mean, obviously these antibiotic resistant bacteria in the sewage water, but it sounds like a scary world that you're wading through with our wastewater. So what does concern you at the end of the day?
You know, one thing that does make me feel good is how well our wastewater is treated. So while we can use untreated wastewater to kind of understand what's going on in the community, once it goes through the wastewater treatment plant, it's really clean. So that's an upside to all of this. The thing that does keep me up at night is actually what happened with the pandemic. This is something, as a microbiologist, for years we would talk about at, you know, kind of the happy hour after scientific meetings, you know, what the big global pandemic. And it was really shocking to see it unfold, you know, in my lifetime, because we have not had anything like this for 100 years. So I'm still grappling with even just the last 2 years, how this all unfolded, because it really is extraordinary. And I think we have to all, you know, understand that this was not business as usual. This really was a serious and extraordinary event that happened.
Sandra McClellan, our guest, professor in the School of Freshwater Sciences at UW-Milwaukee, looking at a leading indicator for where we might find COVID next. And as we started the conversation, Sandra, you talked about a lull in the current rate of COVID in our wastewater right now. I want to give out the phone number one last time if you want to jump in and ask a question, 1-800-642-1234. But sort of take us through this timeline and bring us up to speed at where we are now as the indicators that you watch for COVID. And how you interpret what's next?
Yeah, so when we look at kind of the wastewater record, we have seen kind of the surge in late 2020, and then we saw it drop over summer, and we saw it rise again, and now it's really far down. So, you know, I'm hoping that it's going to stay down. I do anticipate, though, with any infectious disease, it's always changing. So we might need to be prepared next fall that it's going to go up again. And I think the most important thing we can do is get vaccinated and stay up to date with our boosters. We're talking immunity waning within 6 months. So I don't think we can let our guard down. And, you know, but one really positive thing that has come out of this in the scientific community is we have learned a lot, and we have had a lot of students and postdocs and trainees working with us. And I really feel like within our public health system and within science itself, we really have a new group of experts that's going to help us stay ahead of it, as opposed to just reacting to, like I said earlier, this extraordinary event that we just haven't seen in 100 years. I think we're going to be much more savvy and much more prepared on the scientific front.
Yes, as you mentioned, the microbiologists sitting around in happy hour talking about the theoretical pandemic before the actual pandemic hits. But now that it's hit, you have actual hands-on experience, and so you have students coming up who have dealt with a pandemic. Do you see the future of an endemic when it comes to COVID, Sandra?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it certainly is going to go into the endemic phase. And I think, you know, our National Institute of Health has put so much investment in treatments that if vulnerable people do get sick, I feel like they have a better chance than they did when this first started and we didn't have some of the treatments we have. And of course, we have vaccination. And I think that's how we really keep it endemic and keep it at low levels, to keep enough of us immune to it.
And that is what we have heard throughout this hour from our experts, that vaccine is our front and center if you are they are available to you. Sandra, I want to thank you so much for showing us this pandemic through your eyes this morning and through the work that you do. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me this morning.
Sandra McClellan, professor in the School of Freshwater Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. Reminder, you can find all this anytime on our website at wpr.org/mornings, including all the links to our guests and their information. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Kate Archer-Kent today, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.